Today's episode of The Watch is sponsored by ADT. ADT can design and install a smart home just for you, backed by 24/7 protection. It features services like Doorman Service, which is an ADT automation that unlocks the door for packages, friends, or your kids, or Turndown Service, an ADT automation that arms your system, locks your doors, and turns down your lights and thermostat. It's all controlled from the ADT app or the sound of your voice and backed by 24/7 protection. Just visit ADT.com/smart to learn more about how ADT can design and install a secure smart home just for you.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, he just can't quit me, it's Andy Greenwald!
Whoa!
We only have a guest appearance from you today. What's up, man?
You know, I just got a little nervous. You were moving on so easily without me.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we're just going to keep going to the bullpen. We'll see who we find, you know, Katie Nolan any day now. So it's just one of those things.
Man, young Wally Pipp here in the high desert.
Yeah, how's it going?
It's good. You know, I just landed back here. I was home for a nice weekend. Didn't connect with you because you were up, I don't know what you were doing. You're just living your best North Face life up in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, I love Seattle so much. I was up in Seattle and I was up on Orca's Island. And Greenwald, I had the best pizza I've had since I left New York in Seattle.
Wow, this is big talk.
At Delancey, do you know about that spot?
I know about Delancey because the co-owner used to run this blog, Orangette, so I read about her journey to making a pizzeria up there. It's really good, huh?
It was sick. I had a pepperoni pie and a chocolate chip cookie with a scoop of vanilla ice cream, and I was ready to go straight to my grave.
God, that sounds like some real, like, Proustian stuff. That sounds like you were about to put on your catcher's mask and just do 9 innings of Little League again.
I know. It's definitely like what dad gets you after you hit a double. Greenwald, what's going on with
hey,
you?
Man.
What do you want to talk about?
Ooh, I've just given a report. I feel like my voice is going a little bit from all that heavy-duty parenting I've been doing the last couple of
but
days.
But can we be transparent? This is production eve, isn't it?
Yeah, man. We start filming tomorrow. After all this time, we are filming tomorrow.
What is the first shot you guys have to do?
The first shot is of a character arriving in town at an airfield.
Nice.
We do not, this is the question, like, there have been many things that have been going on in my life, like many new events, many new opportunities, and the one thing that my father really wants to know about is, do you shoot it in the order it's written in the script, or no? And he's asked me that no fewer than 5 times in the last few weeks.
That's cool. I did a solid 10 minutes telling my mom over her iPad phone how to turn off her iPhone today. So...
That's much worse. So let me assure you, we do not shoot it in order.
Okay.
But we're in a very great place. We're very excited. We had a great time the last few weeks. We had the cast come in for a table read. Last week we did camera tests where everybody puts on their uniforms and costumes and does a little dancing in front of the camera, and everything looked great. Blew some stuff up just to practice. That actually had nothing to do with the podcast with the show. It's just something just to make, you do for fun here.
Just to loosen up. Is Jay Ferguson okay now that the Cowboys are residing in the basement of the NFC East?
I'm really glad you asked that question. For people who don't check the trades, which I hope is everyone, I'm so excited that in our incredible cast we have J.R. Ferguson, who was Stan on Mad Men. And also was Headley in Twin Peaks The Return, which might even rank higher in my book. He is in our show, and he's an incredible guy. He's wonderful. His beard is luxurious, and don't you worry, we're not going to touch a precious hair on it. But the biggest problem, and I feel like, Chris, you're dialed into this with me, is that he is like a diehard Dallas Cowboys fan. Like, like he wears just cowboy gear.
Yeah.
Like, just cowboy shorts. And it's just like, it's no longer microaggressions. It's macroaggressions to me. Every time we meet, he is wearing basically like a Jason Witten cosplay uniform. And it's rough. We watched the Eagles game together the other night, and he didn't even pretend not to be delighted when Nick Foles was failing early on in the game. But to your point, they didn't do so great yesterday.
Yeah, it's the wrong time for him to try and troll Philadelphia fans, because Dallas sucks, and the Eagles haven't lost since last, like, January.
I'm just saying he has gone radio silent since yesterday's game. So let's just hope he shows up to shoot. That's all I got to say. I mean, we're going to get through this. If he and I can get through this, then truly miracles are possible.
Is there any pop cultural observations you wanted to share with the listeners before we move on? I got Allison Herman here to talk about The Deuce and Shoemaker to talk about Ozark.
I love The Deuce. How come people aren't talking about The Deuce? I mean, I know you and Allison are going to, and I'm thrilled, but I was kind of surprised what a quiet, it felt like, culturally quiet return it had this weekend.
I think football had a lot to do with that last night, to some extent, because people spent 13 hours watching games, and the Sunday night game was, like, ridiculously good last night. So I imagine that kind of blotted out the sun a little bit. But
fair.
I think that this is sort of an issue, and I'm going to talk to Allison about that. There is a little bit of like a reliability, the sort of reliability fatigue with David Simon, George Pelicano shows, which is a terrible thing. But it's basically like, of course it's good. Of course it's insightful. Of course it's very sensitive and urbane about like the state of the world back then and what it means now. Do you think people just get tired of it being good?
I wonder, and that would be a shame if that's the case. I'll say that the feeling that I got from watching the season premiere, season two of The Deuce, really was just low-level hum of joy that a David Simon and Pelicano show gives me. And I understand why it's easy to overlook that, because, you know, other than those that are drug-induced on the part of the characters, the highs aren't particularly, I mean, it's not like a series or season premiere of Ozark in terms of what it's trying to accomplish in 56 minutes, but it's really rare to have a show that is just that pleasurable. Like, 1 year in, when, you know, and this episode was so smartly built as like an around the world on behalf of the Vincent character, just visiting every aspect of the ecosystem, I was happy to see everyone.
Sure.
I was so excited to see everyone as if they were much older friends. So, you know, look, call me old fashioned, call me sleep deprived. That's still what I like in my TV show.
All right, old fashioned. I'm going to let you go. Good luck tomorrow. Hopefully we can keep these little check-ins going. It won't be Emmy season without you.
I can't let go. You have to pry my knuckles off of this microphone that I'm not using because I'm on the phone, but the metaphor stands.
All right, brother. Take care.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
All right. Now I am joined by Allison Herman. Allison, I wanted to have you on to talk about The Deuce.
I love talking about The Deuce. Let's go.
Are enough people talking about The Deuce? Andy and I were just chatting for a second there, and he was just like, did this, like, the reception felt a little muted last night. I don't know if Twitter is, like, a really good barometer of Deuce passion, but, like I said, because last night was also, like, start of the football season, so maybe it wasn't as much, like, hey, Frankie and Vincent are back, but I can't tell if, like, people are excited about this show like we are.
Well, I think we're operating in a TV landscape right now that really does not prize consistency, which totally makes sense. I mean, even just putting the giant sports apparatus that just kicked into gear last night aside, just speaking in terms of scripted TV, last night was the second season premiere of The Deuce, but it was also the premiere of a new Jim Carrey vehicle, TV show since In Living Color. And also this, you know, we were joking about it before it aired, but Lifetime has this new kind of funny dramedy You, which is a little creepy.
Yeah,
it's just sort of like there are two high to semi-high profile releases, and then in the middle you have David Simon giving like the unsexiest possible portrayal of the sex industry. And also, we should probably mention there are probably some behind-the-scenes considerations in terms of, I'm not sure HBO wanted to necessarily put this as much in the spotlight because there's the whole James Franco of it all that they have to deal with.
Sure.
So I didn't get the sense that, I saw one David Simon interview in Rolling Stone. I saw a few advance reviews from people who were like, this is a big HBO drama, so I owe it some coverage. But I don't think HBO was really like pulling out all the stops the way they were when they first launched the show.
Everything about this show in a weird way is traditional. Like even the trailers were very like, you know, hey, it's 1977 in New York, and here's all the characters, and here's a couple of things that are sort of galvanizing, you know, incidents, but there's not, like, a lot of heightened high-concept drama the way Westworld and True Detective have these sort of basically movie trailers to introduce their seasons. So, yeah, you're right. The promo on it was a little muted. Do you want to talk about the James Franco of it all? Because I think one of the interesting things about it, aside from, you know, whether or not he should be allowed to be in this show, basically, based on the allegations against him, is the specific role roles he is playing in this and the way in which he's like interacting with this world.
Yeah, I definitely want to refer your listeners to Sonia Soraya wrote a really great piece in Vanity Fair in which she makes what I think is a very compelling case that a lot of the specific allegations against Franco had to do with his actions as a director in terms of filming sex scenes. And so much of the thematic points of The Deuce are about how this stuff is presented. And, you know, the arc of Maggie Gyllenhaal's character this season is all about her being a director and what it means to shoot porn from a female perspective. And basically, she made the argument that allowing Franco to retain such a prominent role in the show directly undercuts a lot of the themes and arguments that The Deuce is trying to make about the exploitation and possible not exploitative applications of the sex industry. I don't have a definitive answer. I will also say, you know, George Pelicanos talked on your show about how they were going to make these big time jumps in between seasons, and it was almost going to be kind of an anthology. And one of the things that just surprised me about the content of this episode is it's a 5-year jump that does not quite feel like a 5-year jump. There's some progress in a lot of these characters' lives, but basically all the ensemble remains in place as it was in season one, and the changes are not necessarily as drastic. Like, I was particularly surprised to find that you know, one of the central tensions of season one is these pimps who are primarily African-American men facing their own redundancy as things move indoors and more legitimate and towards the porn industry. And lo and behold, Cece, the pimp character, is still acting as this kind of de facto agent slash unprofessional hanger-on
for
to Lori.
Emily Mead's character, yeah.
So I think I was just surprised as a whole that they didn't necessarily make as much use of the time jump as I thought, but also that presents an opportunity to do some cast turnover that they did not do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, so sometimes there are things that happen that feel like they are kind of pulled from the center of the Venn diagram of the things that I'm interested in. And definitely 1977 New York and punk rock and the cultural explosion that was happening then are among the things I am most interested in the world. And I grew up like listening to punk rock and really idealizing New York City in the late 70s and early 80s and the art scene that came out of that whole area. So it's sort of funny sometimes when you get that, you know, when you get to watch the thing that you're so fascinated by. The thing that really threw me off watching it, it basically took me until the scene where Maggie Gyllenhaal and David Krumholtz are discussing editing techniques of pornography, is basically adjusting back to the rhythm of the show. And to the rhythm of like the Simon Pelicanos way in general. I think it's very deliberate. The scenes are all more or less paced the same way. You know, they're kind of pitched at the same, especially in this episode, at the same frequency. And after, I think, a week of watching like Ozark and American Vandal screeners and this sort of like maybe even Saul, where it's like this high concept or really tense, quicksilver kind of feeling, to go back to like, oh, okay, somebody's going to walk into a room and then they're going to have a little bit of a chat before they discuss what they're actually doing in this scene. And then they're going to finish that chat and then we're just going to move into another one. And I thought that there were some incredible moments, though, in the premiere.
And it is a hang. And I think what's really interesting about, you know, the way it works, first of all, I thought the 77 of it all kind of came more into focus with the aesthetics of it. Like the fact that Margarita LaViva's character, Abby, is managing this bar and she's basically turned it into a punk haven.
Yeah, she's got Patti Smith hair. Yeah.
And the gay bar is a lot more of a disco. But also, you know, the thematics of the season, as we're watching the, like, I guess you would call it gentrification of the sex industry, a lot of the frisson of danger that comes with having a cast that's about, I think last season, basically half the characters were streetwalkers. Mm-hmm. When you move it indoors, not to say that the porn industry is not dangerous and rife with exploitation, I would not be surprised if we see a character overdose, for example, this season. You're not getting that. You know, one of the climactic events of last season was a prostitute who was killed by a John pushing her out a window. And you're not really getting that, you know, little bit of life or death to it all. Mm-hmm. And then you just get the Simon and Pelicanos rhythm, as you mentioned. Like, you're just watching people speak good words. And for me, at least, it's massively pleasurable. And I feel like I haven't actually said that I still really enjoy this show. And I think this is a great season. It's just not a flashy season.
Yeah. And I think that I wonder whether or not for people like us and possibly, I would imagine for a lot of the people listening to the podcast, if you're watching a lot of TV, this now feels like an experiment. Whereas, in fact, it's very much in line with everything that they've been doing since The Wire, but it actually, in the face of a lot of television now, feels almost experimental in its pacing and in its... It's basically an ideas show. It's a show about individuals being crushed by institutions and being crushed by history because we know what happens.
And it's like a plotless show, right? It's not, you know, I conducted an extremely unscientific Twitter poll just based on,
I had
a couple of real life conversations where people told me basically, I like the show, I recognize it's objectively a good show, and yet I found myself kind of trailing off after four episodes because I didn't feel like it had a sense of direction, which was more or less borne out by what I heard by my followers who responded. Thank you to those who did. But yeah, exactly. It's not a show that really grabs you in a way because you don't really know. You're watching history unfold in a thousand very small and subtle ways. You're not really, the question is not, you know, is Vinny going to make it? It's not, is Maggie Gyllenhaal's character Candy going to be a huge star? Even though you can tell the general trajectory of everyone, you're really there to just watch Maggie Gyllenhaal and David Krumholtz, who's looking great, by the way. You're just there to watch them, like, talk about the female gaze in this like art porn movie she made. You're not, I'm not really like, oh, is she going to make a movie?
His facial reaction when the lion is chasing the zebra.
Or the orange being crushed.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's what I'm around for.
Yeah. And I'm around for, I think that they do, Pelicanus's crime fiction is very straightforward. It's not straightforward, but it's not florid, I would say. I think it has a journalistic kind of energy. And Simon obviously comes from a journalistic background. And I think they do a lot of almost framing the themes of their shows in an almost journalistic way. They put like a thesis statement or a topic statement in these scenes so that you know why it's an important conversation is because it's about the encroaching gentrification that will happen to Midtown, or it's about this kind of last moment of, I think Matt Zilversites referred to it as kind of like the Weimar Republic era of New York City before
AIDS. Yeah, because the AIDS crisis is coming down the pike. Absolutely.
And, so like you kind of have these signals of like, oh yeah, and of course like they're playing New Rose and stuff like that, you know, but I think that ultimately there are these moments of quite moving poetry, like the scene of Maggie Gyllenhaal in her unitard on the desk dreaming about making a musical is like almost just like Lynchian in the way that it's shot and the way that she's kind of acting. I thought that was remarkable.
I mean, speaking of thesis statements, there's literally a line in this episode where Maggie Gyllenhaal says, "Who would have thought that fucking is the most boring part of porn?" Which is, that is the show. You don't, like, I don't want to say you don't need to watch the show after you hear that line, but that is definitely, they are telling you exactly what they're trying to do and what they're trying to say. But it doesn't feel like a hammer, I guess.
Yeah.
I'm very content to just watch this show proceed and watch over me in the way that they're very different shows, but almost like when I watch Mrs. Maisel, which is the Amy Sherman-Palladino, and you're just like, oh, this person knows how to
and
make
those
TV.
Shows
they've been doing it. They've
been
doing it for years.
Very important connective phone because Lenny Bruce is in the Deuce.
Oh my God! Yes, I forgot about that.
Luke Kirby, who plays Lenny Bruce in Mrs. Maisel and plays Ed Koch's sort of Midtown enforcement lieutenant in the Deuce, and I actually thought that was really cool how he brought, like, I think he had, like, a little bit of a different energy to bring to the show. I hope we get to see a lot more of him this season.
Oh, totally. I think we will, but it's also really interesting to watch, you know, the slow roll of history, speaking of. It's last season, the gentrification was, we're going to take these streetwalkers and we're going to push them indoors to these parlors, and now it's like, we're going to take these cash-only businesses because they don't result in income for the city, and we're going to convert them into money earners,
right,
which totally fits with the Simon thesis of it always comes back around to capitalism. It feels like an extension of the John Lindsay administration last year. It just feels like a really interesting, the fact that you can, I think it was an interesting choice for them to go to 77 and do the Weimar Republic instead of going straight ahead to, like, what happens when porn goes to video? What happens when you have to deal with, you know, the AIDS crisis? But that's a little like, okay, so we're getting this intermediary step. We're getting the next stage of this very gradual process that eventually is going to end in an M&M store.
Yeah, right. And I think that the thing that I like the most about it, or the thing that really hits home the most, is that when you, these guys are all living and these women are all living in this land of vice. And I think we sometimes, at least initially, you associate vice with indulgence or with self-satisfaction, if not self-annihilation. But there's something about it that's supposed to be indulgent. And then you convert it into a job. So everybody, you know, in the end of the episode, and the mobster is telling James Franco's character, you know, enjoy it. You know, like, this is the life we live. Like, we get to have these suits, these cars and stuff like that. But he's been basically awake for 3 days running after his brother, trying to find him because he stole all this money from one of the peep shows. And every character on this show is basically increasingly getting ground down by the professionalization of their industries.
And you also get the labor consciousness, which I thought was a really interesting part of Abby's arc. And I think I can disclose, I've seen like 3 more episodes of this season, and that's something that they really touch on, which is, you know, it's all capitalism, this is work, and the people who are doing the work are laborers. Yeah. They're not lost souls, they're not fallen women, but they are, you know, they're a class.
Yeah.
And it's fun to watch them, you know, draw that line in a way that I think resonates with certain issues of the day today.
Of course, yeah. It's a miraculous show in a lot of ways, so I hope we come back to it later in the season. Thanks for joining me today, Allison.
Thanks for having me.
Today's episode of The Watch is brought to you by ExpressVPN. You're being tracked online by social media sites, marketing companies, and your mobile or internet provider. No joke. Not only can they record your browsing history, but they can often sell it to corporations for profit. So you should take back your privacy with ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN has easy-to-use apps that run seamlessly in the background of your computer, phone, and tablet. Turning on ExpressVPN protection only takes one click, and ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. ExpressVPN is rated the number one service by TechRadar, and it comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee and costs less than $7 a month. So if you ever use public Wi-Fi or you don't want to hand over your online history to your internet service provider, ExpressVPN is the solution. Look, it's like, you don't have to look very far in the news to find stories regarding privacy right now. It seems like every day I'm on 35 more email lists. My phone number is getting sold left and right for robocalls. This is an issue that we're all facing, and ExpressVPN is one step towards taking back your privacy, taking back your internet surfing privacy, encrypting your information, having that extra layer of security so that you can be online, which most of us are all the time, a little bit more safely, a little bit more comfortably. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/watch. That's expressvpn.com/watch for 3 months free with a 1-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/watch to learn more. Today's episode of The Watch is brought to you by Greats. Greats is Brooklyn's first sneaker company, crafting quality, purpose-built footwear. Greats was founded on the idea of building a better sneaker for less. They offer classically inspired styles for both men and women in full and half sizes. Greats sells direct to the consumer, so you get a high-quality product at a value price. Their bestsellers include the all-leather Royale lace-up and the Wooster slip-on. Greats are built using luxury, high-quality materials and premium construction. You can check out Greats online at greats.com or visit them in person in New York, Venice Beach, and select Nordstrom stores across the country. Greats offers free shipping on orders over $75 and a simple exchange process if you need a different size. And if you need help, Greats' support team is available 7 days a week. Greats has been featured in GQ, Vogue, and Esquire, and their shoes have hundreds of 5-star reviews from shoppers. Forbes even described Greats as the next great footwear company. I love my pair of Greats. I got the perforated Royales. They're a great sneaker just to wear to work during the day, and then you can go straight to like a nice dinner at night. They look casual, but they also look formal. It's really flexible, and they're also very comfortable. I just really love wearing them. Get your pair today at greats.com and save 15% on your first purchase with our code WATCH. That's greats.com and code WATCH to save 15%. All right, now I am joined by my lake brother, David Shoemaker in New York City, to talk about Ozark Season 2. Now, Shoemaker and I, we didn't really like agree on like, let's do the first 3 episodes or let's do... So we're going to talk generally about Season 2. I finished it last night. Shoemaker still got a couple left, so we're not going to spoil anything in terms of... I don't think we'll spoil anything major. We won't spoil any possible character deaths or anything like that. We're going to talk more about how we are feeling about this season. And Shoemaker, I want you to go first because I'm still sorting it out.
I will say that I remember the last time I was on the show, I had to make up some things I was not looking forward to or I hoped wouldn't happen in season two. And one thing I said was I hope they wouldn't just keep introducing the next big bad, you know, that just like took the place of the last big bad.
Sure.
they absolutely did that. I think they did it about four times in the first three episodes, and I was totally wrong. It's just as great. The show is just as great as it ever was. It's like, in some ways, it like doesn't. I you know, I'm all in the bag for this show, so I'm just gonna make excuses for it. But the bigger and weirder the show gets, the more the focus is, I mean, the more the bird family is just put into relief, and it makes it just so much kind of more interesting and compelling.
Yeah. I think that what I wanted from this show was a pretty unique ask that would have been probably not a good television show this season, which is essentially to keep moving at the same pace and to keep moving in a world without morality, which is essentially the thing that made it such a strange watch and such like an intoxicating watch in the first season, is that Marty is moving so fast and moving his family through so much turmoil that he never really stops to have the, like, am I a bad person conversation, you know? And he's basically spinning so many different, not lies, but he's covering up so many different numbers, and he's moving things around, and he's got, you know, his life are these little shell companies. And when he finally has to do a full accounting, which I think happens over the course of the second season, there are some more traditional aspects going on in terms of a reckoning of who he is, who he's becoming, what he wants to be, who he feels like he should be. But that being said, even though it kind of lost some of the thing that made it completely unique in my mind, I thought this season was quite entertaining. It was really, 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 really fun.
Well, I mean, that hectic pace and that, like, you know, the no stopping to reconcile, you know, morality actually becomes sort of a plot, or at least a minor plot line in the show.
Right.
Increasingly, as the second season goes on, they are, you know, sort of self-aware in that way. And I think, you know, that's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think that you're right, that, like, the perfect version of this show is maybe a little bit hard to nail down.
It's at least hard to sustain, right? Like, you could have done a 7-episode season that just moved at the same pace as the last season, but I look at season 2 as actually more of an extension of season 1 thematically and narratively, rather than, because I was kind of thinking what they'll do is the casino will be up and running. You know, like, I thought we would join them 6 months, 9 months, 13 months later, and they would have this casino, and then something else would happen. And instead, it starts relatively soon after the first season ends.
Yeah, I think that's a really smart way of looking at it. In some ways, this second season has been just sort of a sidebar or a sequel to the first season, you know, in a broad thematic way. You know, I mean, the first season was very much Jason Bateman's show. And I think, you know, almost all of the shows that we love in season one are about one character, or you can think of them as being a sort of, like, you
absolutely
know, protagonist driven show. And then they expand out into these huge universes where, like, the 18th most important character, you know, actor is just as important as the main character, or who used to be the main character. And in season 2, you see them giving a lot of time and significance to the other members of the Bird family. I mean, Laura Linney in season 1 might as well have just been like a bump in Q rating for the show.
Yes.
You know, I mean, she was really fantastic, but there was, I spent a lot of time wondering why that Laura Linney was there.
I think the second season is our answer.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, for all the great shows, you know, I mean, no knocks on watch favorites like The Americans, but there've been a lot of shows where the casting of child actors has gone awry, and man, they just, like, lucked out so much with both of the kids in the show. But Jonah especially is just like, he's just like a proper actor, man. And he's like carrying scenes and storylines and stuff. And it's without giving too much away, there is, you know, he becomes as significant in the sort of paralleling season 1 aspect of season 2 as anybody else.
I think one of the things that sort of defines the second season is three women who sort of rise to power over the course of the season. And that's, obviously, it's Darlene, Jacob Snell's wife. Mm-hmm. It's Helen, a cartel boss played by the great British actress Janet McTeer. And obviously Laura Linney. And Laura Linney, she basically has a Michael Corleone arc, you know. And I think one of the things that's fascinating about this show is that by placing essentially like squares in this criminal underworld and asking them to sort of find out who they are when they're living without a net and without the sort of cottoning of everyday regular life, they find out that their lives are actually, perhaps they feel more alive than they did before. And I think that that happened a little bit in the beginning of the first season with Marty. And it certainly happens this season with Laura Linney as Wendy. And she's fucking phenomenal in this show.
Yeah, she's really, really good. I mean, there's no doubt in the world, obviously, that she's an incredible actor. But the way that she is, just as her character is like suddenly thrust in this weird world and has to inhabit a new sort of persona in the Ozarks, like Laura Linney is carrying scenes in a show that seemed to be, you know, up through season one, sort of entirely built around Jason Bateman and like character actors doing twangy accents,
yeah.
You know? I mean, so like Laura Linney is like a full anchor of this show now, and it's fantastic.
I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about that idea of whether or not second seasons and whether or not shows in general need to go wider or go deeper. Because I think they chose to go deeper with mostly the same cast of characters with a lot of the same sort of end goals for each of those characters rather than bringing in a ton of new people, which I think they could have done had they done just Straight to the Riverboat or done a little bit more of a time jump. Did you feel like over the course of the episodes that you've watched that you came to appreciate characters like Jacob or, you know, Wyatt more? Or was there a part of you that was like, I kind of wish there was like a different group of folks interacting here?
I mean, this show is still relatively young, so I'm not upset that we don't have a whole bunch more people. I think that, there's certainly an aspect of the show where it feels like they're a little bit too in love with their cast. And I don't know, I guess that's the wrong way of saying it. They're despite all of the craziness that happens on the show, I mean, plot-wise and everything else, there's not, you know, this isn't a show where you feel like all of your favorite characters are in mortal danger all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, and maybe that's just because of the being on Netflix. I don't know what it is. I just don't, you know, I don't expect, you know, when I hope it's not too much of a spoiler to say that Rachel, Jordana Spiro's character, reappears this season. And it was sort of it was presented as a sort of twist, but it was no surprise, right? I mean, we the way that she left, but also just the vibe of the show. You know, we had a couple of deaths last season of significant characters. But then there's a point in this season where characters die. And I think it really helps to keep you on your toes and realize that, like, you know, this show is... It gives some fucks, but it wants you to know that like that it's willing to go to the excesses of its predecessors at certain moments. And you know, I mean, again, this wouldn't be a terrible spoiler even if I said it, but I'm not going to go into it. But there's one character who was was around the entire first season, really becomes like the emotional core of season two, it's just a great example of someone who like I. It was almost just like a bit, like not a bit part, but just a bit.
Yeah.
And I was so happy to like care so much about that character. So anyway, it's interesting that, you know, you mentioned both the Snells. They become simultaneously more sort of lovable and more hateable. But I would say, I mean, they were set up as just villains in season one. So I guess they're definitely skewing towards more lovable. And meanwhile, you know, both of the birds, I mean, both Jason Bateman and Laura Linney are put in just in situations that you like cannot like them.
And I think part of that is because their goals start become very muddy. You know, their stated goal is to protect their family. Their stated goal is like everything mm-hmm. we're doing is because our lives were in danger back in Chicago. And every decision we've made since we got to the Ozarks is to basically prolong our survival. And in fact, there's greater ambition involved there. And I wrote about this when I wrote about the preview of this season, is that ambition and survival are two instincts that can feel very similar because they're very passionate. And I think you see that where there's a lot of confusion about what are we actually trying to do here? Are we trying to become kingpins of this backwater, you know, lake town? Or are we trying to get an exit strategy? And that's the tension. And then what happens is that we see over the course of the season is just like in any family where maybe some decisions are made without consulting with the other person, or there are different alliances or different pockets of power going on, that's getting exploited on like a criminal level. And it winds up being, you know, it winds up taking them such a dark place because it basically becomes punitive towards one another. People are saying, well, you made this decision without me, so I'm going to make this decision without you.
Yeah, exactly. There's no relation. I mean, there's no pure relationships in the show. You know, I mean, even the purest one might be the Snells, you know, and they have some moments of discord this season. You're absolutely right, though. I mean, that level, they make light through, I mean, at various points in season two of the concept of, you know, what their stated goals are.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, they're, if they're not always fully aware of it, then the people around them are, right? And it's like, and their kids sort of calling them on their shit. Like it's always there right in the subtext that there's a question as to whether or not Marty would, you know, dreams of being, of actually being a kingpin, or whether he just is only a problem solver and that continues to lead him down these roads. I don't think as many times as he tells himself that even he would, you know, that even that character believes that they're going to get out when, you know, at the specified deadline or whatever. It's just, it's a never ending cycle. And I think that, you know, they're coming to grips with that.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll maybe jump in a couple weeks when it feels like more people have gotten a chance to watch the whole season aside from crazy people like me and Shoemaker. And maybe we'll do a little bit more of a spoiler conversation about it. But Dave, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, man. I love this show.
Me too. All right, that was David Shoemaker on Ozark and Allison Herman on The Deuce. And we'll keep talking about both of those shows. Later this week, I have an interview with Carlton Cuse and Graham Roland, the showrunners of Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan on Amazon, which has been out for a couple of weeks. I'm really excited to talk to those guys. And we'll probably hit on Better Call Saul as well on Thursday. So put Andy in your prayers as he embarks on production for Briar Patch. And I'll be back on Thursday. Take care.